Boston, the Boston Park Plaza Hotel, which is the headquarters for the 33rd Annual Cognitive Science Conference, COGSci 2011. I'm with David Povel from NYU, who gave an interesting presentation yesterday in the session on the biology of language, which was originated with Noam Chomsky speaking at great length. But in your talk there, you threw out quite a few little bombs, I thought. You were specifically talking about a more muscular approach to neuroscience. You were saying things like, there's no Broca's area, there's no such thing as a Broca's area, and so on and so forth. Lots of revolutionary little thoughts being thrown out there. I mean, what was your attempt? What were you trying to get at there?
Having grown up in this field, you know, the traditions of this field, we operate with certain biological infrastructure and a certain set of concepts. And my message is, in some sense, very simple, is that we've moved quite a bit forwards, and the standard issue assumptions are no longer any good. And not only that's fine, and we should be historically minded, because it's fascinating and important data comes from there, but we have to move on in a way that has to not just take the ladder, but actually now kick it away. So Broca's area, for instance, is a part of the brain that was actually carefully defined by Broca himself, had a particular anatomic definition, and was related to a particular deficit, and did important duty clinically, and became really an iconic image in neuroscience, right? It was the first image about localization of function in a foundational document of modern neuroscience. And if we continue talking about it in those terms, it's a kind of simplification that's misleading. It's no longer helpful. Because the granularity of analysis of neurobiology is so different that we need to respect it. Not incorporating that seems to me a rather bankrupt approach. The brain is, you know, pretty complicated place. It's a small place. Yeah, it has about the same number. You know, there are 100 billion neurons, say. That's the number we typically kick around. It's the same number of stars as the Milky Way. But in a space that's, let's say, the size of two fists squeezed together. So that raises a very different kind of game. And we continue to operate with a kind of conceptual architecture that's no longer helpful. And when we talk about things like trying to understand the neurobiological foundations of language processing, I think it's time to try some really radical new ideas and move forwards.
So I know that you're a professor of psychology and neuroscience, not just psychology.
Yeah.
So there's obviously a...
Well, so I moved to NYU a few years ago. Before that, I was actually at the University of Maryland College Park for a number of years, where I was a professor of linguistics and neuroscience. So I do have some, you know, formal training and intuitions about the nature of the problem is what we're trying to work with, and to try to find these linking hypotheses is tricky. And the reason I'm kind of hoping for a more muscular cognitive science is because our default assumption as cognitive scientists, so wearing my cognitive scientist's hat, is that we defer to the neurobiologist. We say, boy, you know, neuroscience is a hard science, and cognitive science or linguistics is part of, you know, psychology or even the social sciences on a bad day. And therefore we basically are all naive reductionists. We assume that the things that we study have to be reduced to the parts list of neurobiology. I want to change that. I think that's wrong. I think we have to have what I mean by muscular stance is that we say, look, we take the ontological structure of cognitive science dead seriously. We think that the primitives, or the parts list, is actually correct. And it's you guys, as neuroscientists, who owe us some wiring diagrams, some new evidence of how the neurobiological circuitry forms the basis for this. So it's to achieve a genuine linkage or unification between, you know, in this case, linguistics and neuroscience, we have to stop being naive reductionists of this type. It's just not going to happen. That's my pessimistic stance. Optimistically, I think there's a way forward. So.
Hmm. That was a packed room last night.
Absolutely.
Do you think there was a generally agreed upon model of the mind in that room? I mean, there's so many different schools of thought. I mean, there's the connectionist, there's all the neural net stuff. Mm-hmm. The brain as a general purpose computer, the brain as a massively modular organ with evolved gadgets from the Pleistocene, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah.
The
sort of Swiss Army knife model of
this. You think there's a prevailing theme in that room last night?
Well, certainly not in that session. But I do think that there are some prevailing themes emerging, and that were, and I think that Noam Chomsky's talk in part was addressed against that prevailing theme, and that is what he called in his talk very provocatively the non-existence thesis. That is to say, there is no such thing as a computational organ that's the language system. It's you basically have massive statistical analyses of input structure, you do higher order statistics, and you pretty much derive the categorical structure of language processing, which is quite interesting. And I do think that that's actually the prevailing theme. Regardless of the different flavors of cognitive science that were represented, there is, I think, an overall thrust or tendency to want to explore data-driven and statistical approaches and learning-driven approaches to cognitive science, in distinction to the idea that you come with a particularly designed, let's say, chip to the task. That language processing works and is the way it is because it has certain features. The mind-brain has properties that just are the way they are, and language is like that because it doesn't follow from other generic principles, but from those specific computational principles. And that's an interesting, and I think there is a tension. I think that's the reason that Chomsky gives that kind of talk, and whether it's right or wrong, is we don't know. These are questions for research for the next 50 years. It's very hard. Remember that the purely statistical approach, which is clearly, I do think it's the prevailing one in a room like there was last night, makes strong assumptions about what kind of things a learner, you and I, can take in, process, chunk in the right way, and then use for counting and for deriving higher order representation. That's actually very challenging. I don't think you can have that for free, and I think that's sort of the message of that kind of lecture.
But you would say that, I mean, you in your talk, you actually had a little quote at the beginning. It was from a 1959 critique by Chomsky of B.F. Skinner.
Yes.
And in his process of demolishing behaviorism. Mm-hmm. You would say that Chomsky's views have evolved?
His views have very much evolved, although I think some of the core logical assumptions have remained as far as I know the literature since the late 1950s. My quote from the Skinner review, of course, was partly just inflammatory rhetoric because it's cute, but it's also quite right. So what that quote represents is, for all of us, can we actually even ask a question that can be answered in an explanatory way? In a satisfying way, and not just something entirely superficial. So that's what. And the issues that he raised about the nature of linguistic representation, as my critique of that is, well, I don't think those are developed in a way that we can actually attack them neurobiologically yet. This is what I talked about in this mismatch of trying to align the alignment problem between the linguistic primitives and the neurobiological primitives. So that's what I take to be the kind of fundamental challenge. If we take all of the cognitive scientists in that room and we say, please put your cards on the table, what do you think are the irreducible primitives of your area of research? You're quite right, there's going to be a long and conflicting list, but there's also going to be some agreement. And let's just take the kind of Venn diagram of agreed upon primitives. Maybe there's only going to be, five. And let's do the same thing for neurobiology. Still, there is absolutely no systematic linkage between those concepts. There's an ontological incommensurability between those. And that's the challenge we face. I think it's a challenge that Randy Galistel rightly emphasizes in, you know, much of his work and in his recent book. Neurobiology doesn't have, I mean, we just don't know how any information is represented at all. So to develop linking hypotheses between cognitive science, or the primitives of cognitive science, and the primitives of neurobiology remains a formidable challenge for which there's we need, my own recommendation is, and what a lot of people are following, is a kind of computational neuroscience approach, but one that's let's say, representationally sophisticated.
What do you mean by saying that we don't know how representations work? I mean,
well, in a neurobiological sense, we really don't. I mean, so look, what is, you know, how do you, let's say, cat. What's the neurobiological representation of cat? Well, yeah, we don't, we're done. This discussion is then over, right? I mean, we actually don't have, we don't have an answer to that. So, look, I mean, I work on this sort of thing, you know, and I have rather detailed ideas about all the different subparts that have to be done and where in the brain that might be done. But the fact of the matter is we don't actually know. How is, you know, or let's say, you know, how can you find your car? And we say, well, there's a space map, you know, you have hippocampal representations. But as soon as we invoke that vocabulary, we're, you know, that's all metaphoric. That's just metaphor. We don't actually know how it's done. We don't know how it's calculated, right? We have some vague ideas, but we don't have any details. How is information represented? That is the question, right? How in neurobiological, it's an old and slightly boring problem of philosophy of mind. And we are, I think, this is maybe strange, but I think we are actually innately dualists. All right? So we, when we start talking about mental phenomena of this type, we are quite happy to invoke different forms of science, different forms of generalization than when we talk about, let's say, neurons. That's the challenge we have to overcome. It's a very difficult methodological challenge.
Right, so but when people talk about, if you look at all the things that have been working, and we were talking about the Rummelhart Prize and so on, and Dave Rummelhart, parallel distributed processing, computational neuroscience, neural nets, and so on and so forth, these are not concepts that allow you to answer your question about.
These are intermediate steps, and these are approaches to allow you to try to formalize the problem, but they're not an answer. So look, let's take something like a distributed thing. So, you know, maybe I have, you know, 10 neurons, 100,000 neurons. Why neurons? Do you think that, you know, what's the evidence that the neuron is a computational primitive of that type in a biological sense? Well, you have none. Or let's say spike or spike train. So in my own work, for instance, I'm trying to relate, you know, the kind of brain activation you get from the human brain, let's say with EEG or MRI or MEG, to spike trains, because spike trains are the sort of currency of brain function. So that's beginning to be a little bit more tractable. But now what? I mean, what does it mean to say 5 spikes versus 10 spikes are the representation or encoding of something? That's, you know, recasting the question in a slightly different way, but it's still not an explanatory answer. It's just another correlation, which is fine. I mean, I think, you know, so in some sense, my message is to have sophisticated cognitive science model, whether from, you know, linguistics or memory research, who cares? A sophisticated and kind of explicit cognitive science model is wonderful. But instead of now forcing ourselves, this is my main small message. Instead of saying, look, I need to align what I have in my theory to what's given to us by neuroscience, I think that's the non-muscular approach. The muscular approach is to say, I'm actually as committed to my architecture as you biologists are to yours, but I think you owe me an explanation of my things. I don't have to align to you. You have to align to me. You know, Salk Institute neurobiologists have to show me a circuit that actually does the kind of thing that I know to be right. So let's take some extremely simple operation, something that actually came up in Chomsky's talk and that I mentioned as well, which is just you have to concatenate two items, right? So this is a, you know, super generic kind of operation, and maybe give it a label. So you take an X and a Y and you turn it into a Z. You know, this is hardly brain science, right? Solving such a trivial seeming problem is actually very deep, extremely deep, and the focus of much contemporary research. And so, it's at that level of analysis that we really have to bite in. And so why shouldn't we go to a neuroscience lab and say, you know, there is absolutely no question that whatever theory of mind you prefer, you have to be able to do this. This is uncontroversial. Please show me. You really, you know, you think that neuron A, neuron B, and neuron 3, that's the answer? Well, that's interesting. Show me how to do that. But I think we should be confident in our own generalizations, in the evidence that we adduce for cognitive models, and not see ourselves as the weaker link in cognitive neuroscience, but as an equal partner that has demands. Why not?
What did you mean by the cartographic imperative?
All of us are seduced by the wonderful engineering feats that have developed, that the new imaging technologies allow us to have. So whether you're using fMRI or MEG, it's just fantastic that you can take a picture from the outside of the inside of someone's head with, you know, really quite remarkable resolution. Say, you know, on the order of a millimeter spatial resolution and a millisecond temporal resolution. That's fantastic. Now, we use it, it's the dominant technique, and what we do is create spatial images with, you know, very high resolution. But the assumption is once we've created a spatial image that we're actually done. As we just try to make maps of things, and we say, look, when we did this spatial task, or we did this language task, and we found here's, you know, area 1, area 2, and area 3. That's fabulous. But my warning, in some sense, is, look, that does not constitute an explanation. So the cartographic imperative means that we seem to want to make maps of everything. That's the imperative we live by. And my complaint about it is to say, that's wonderful, but that's just the homework problem. That's just an intermediate step. To really take the next step, we have to go beyond localization of function and really try to understand these circuit-level properties. As making maps is not sufficient for explanation. It's a wonderful intermediate homework step to the next level, but it's not enough. That being said, so as a person who reviews this kind of literature, who edits a journal and so on,
You also do a blog, don't you?
I do a blog that's even sometimes read. People sometimes even look at. The vast majority of the research in this field is about localization of function, and then the discussion of the paper stops there. We had condition A and condition B. They differed. Here are the representative blobs. This one was bigger. Now I'm done. But that can't possibly be what we aim for in this research. We have to have a bigger yearning. We can't just stop with saying we've now created a little map. Don't we want an accounting of that map? Why is it the way it is? Why is that? So, you know, now it was very much in vogue to say, well, look, it's not just the activation of a particular area or a particular blob. It's a network. Okay, how much more have you achieved then? So now you have 5 blobs instead of 3, and maybe the 5 blobs are connected. Is that a deeper explanation? Not as far as I can see. It just means you have 5 blobs, and maybe you can have some interesting, let's say, dynamic causal modeling of the interconnectivity of them. That is still just a spatial answer. Though a spatial answer is an excellent answer if you had a spatial question. So if we have theories that demand a spatial answer, then our techniques are perfect. But that's not what our theories are. Our theories are theories of mind. What is the parts list of the mind? And how does the parts list of the brain form the basis for the parts list of the mind? That's what's at stake, right? The parts of the primitives. So we're a bunch of people in a garage, and we're taking the thing apart into all this. You know, there's 5 screws, and there's 10 things of this type. That's what our challenge is, and we're not meeting it. We're just shirking that challenge at the moment.
Right. Do you think there is such a thing as a language organ then?
I do believe in the sort of conceptual foundations of where that comes from. So there are particular, so the notion of specialization that Lisa Newport also raised. And so there are, here's where I think a lot more could be done. One of the things that's very peculiar about the language system is that we have such a remarkable, so there's an interface with the memory system that seems to be highly specialized. So let's take, you know, we're probably, you know, average speakers of English, although I'm actually a German, so my German is a little better than my English, but the and we have a vocabulary of the size of, let's say, 20,000 words. You know, maybe you have a larger one. I probably have a slightly smaller one. Those are stored somewhere in your memory system, in your hard disk, right? Now, looking at this problem from far away, that's actually quite tricky. So you have 20,000 things stored somewhere, but they're made up of a small set of elements, let's say phonemes, if you want. So from a storage point of view, they're very similar. You use some small set, you know, A, B, C, D, E. You build those up and you store those somewhere. But those have to be unique entities, right? So you have 20,000 individuated items. And now on the fly, as we're having this conversation, each of those words you have to pull out takes you about 200 milliseconds. You know, on average we speak, you know, let's say something like 2 to 3 words per second, about 5-6 syllables per second, is the typical rate that we're entertaining right now. But that places extremely high demands on the system. That means that the storage of the words, they have to be in a format of representation. This is what we don't know, right? We don't know the answer. Is it Microsoft Brain? Is it MATLAB? How is this stuff actually stored? What's the form? So it has to be stored somewhere in a way that they're individuated, right? So they're, you know, you don't actually make mistakes. When you want to say cat, you say cat and not CAD or not MAT. And you have to do this on the fly at an unbelievable rate. I mean, this is so much is just phenomenologically true. Now, that places very interesting constraints on that format. And now we can say, well, once we have an answer to that, well, it must be relatively abstract because it's not all just about recognizing words and storing them. You put them together. That's the whole point. You take an X and a Y and you build a Z. So not that format must be allowing you to store it efficiently, to retrieve it amazingly efficiently, but also to combine it with other units. This combination is actually quite tricky. So because, you know, you can do exciting things like, say, red ball or black jacket. That's actually the expressive power of language, is combinatoric possibilities. And so putting all these things together places very interesting constraints on the degree of specialization. So that's what a language organ is going to be like when it's cached out. You have to have things that are stored in a certain way, that are retrieved in a certain way, and that have a format of representation that allows you to actually build larger units. That, for instance, we say, well, recursivity is an interesting property. Sure, you have to have it so that, you know, you couldn't do it if it weren't the kind of object that allows that.
Could you just explain what recursivity is?
So, I mean, you have to, so suppose we take an X and a Y and we build a Z unit out of that. One of the fascinating things about the kind of representational system we're talking about is that you can take it, again, and put it in itself, right? You can sort of, you can say, you know, we are having this conversation. The cameraman thinks that we are having this conversation. The audio engineer thinks that the cameraman thinks that we're having this conversation, and so on. And that's one of the fantastic aspects of this, that we can, that thought works like that, and it can be expressed in language like that. So these are the kind of things. So if, given that you can do that, it must be the case that the representational chunks that we pull out, let's say roughly the, you know, your mental dictionary, must be of the right format. Very complicated. What is it? Not everything is going to be, you can't just take anything, right? That's a very difficult problem. I mean, we treat it, so the fact that you can say, you know, red ball, we think is some kind of triviality, but it's actually very deep. It's very deep. It's a very hard problem that you can do anything like that. And we treat it, you know, we sort of skirt these things aside as if it were something that we just kind of solve in an afternoon walk. But these are, you know, profound research programs. What is the nature of linguistic representation? And so to come back to your the originary question, yes, I think there are specializations of a kind that where the most straightforward answer, there's an organ, which means there's, and to some extent it means there's specialization. The example that I gave in my lecture yesterday is the specialization of the circuitry for sound localization. So when we talk about it in that case, and I gave the example of, you know, barn owl sound localization, it's extremely well understood. really from soup to nuts. You know, we can manipulate this at the molecular level. It's a beautiful piece of biology and computational neuroscience.
This is Markinishi's work you were talking
about. Markinishi, Catherine Carr have done just fantastically beautiful, it's really links neurobiology, molecular biology, computational neuroscience, and psychophysics in a just extremely elegant way. It's just sort of, you know, makes my mouth water. This is what I would want to have. And we have absolutely no qualms about saying, well, there's an extremely high degree of specialization in that case. Now we turn to language, and it raises people's blood pressure. When you say, well, there must be a degree of specialized computation of a certain type, people say, oh, no, I should derive that from general principles. But why? I mean, I don't see why. I mean, we're quite comfortable attributing extreme, you know, let's say, a sound localization organ to an animal's computation like that. Why is it a blood pressure raising event to say something similar about language processing? That seems to me completely unnecessary. I think it's what's good enough for the serious study of the barn owl should also be applied fairly to the study of human, you know, comprehension, language production, and so on. Hmm. So therefore, I'm completely not offended by the notion of calling something an organ. It's an old and useful concept. It interacts sociologically with concepts of the history of, you know, psycholinguistics that have, so the notion of modularity has gotten people really, really upset. Lisa Newport raised this concept in her comments. I don't particularly see why we should get upset. I mean, these are research questions. Some computations will be presumably highly modularized. Others need, you know, by necessity to interface with other parts of the cognitive system. So much seems clear. Our job is to try to figure out how things work. Whether we call them this or that seems, you know, it's not going to give us a more interesting mechanistic answer in the near future. We have to, you know, it doesn't do much concrete work in moving us ahead.
Right. As you look back, I mean, do you recall what the stimulus was for your going into this line of work, into science at all? Teacher, parent?
I do recall the stimulus. It was I wanted to be an actor and director. And I worked in the theater, and I'm enough of a ham that I like that kind of thing. And my wife actually was an actress, and a good one, and a successful one. And it seemed like the right thing to do, to have a job that's lets her do that, and one of us have a kind of normal job. And I was at that point working in a visual neuroscience laboratory at MIT. And I was very excited about, you know, I was an undergraduate here, and I'm nerdy enough to like that kind of thing. And while I was working in visual neuroscience with two, you know, very distinguished vision researchers, somebody said, look, you seem so interested in, you know, language type issues. I'm from Munich, Germany, and that's where my family lives. And you, you know, have a certain comfort level with these issues. You should really go listen to this guy Chomsky. Very interesting lectures. So while I was a research assistant at MIT, I went to some of his lectures, and it was like somebody opened the curtains. It was a really formative experience. And I began taking linguistics and psycholinguistics courses pretty quickly, not necessarily because I was sold on the set of ideas, but the way that you could even talk about something like language with this kind of with that kind of approach, method, vocabulary was extremely exciting. It was literally like somebody opened the window to a new world of ideas and approaches to cognitive science. I then in graduate school studied cognitive science and more linguistics, and then later returned to neuroscience. So how you end up doing this work is entirely accidental, I think. It's who you meet in the lab, who you meet on the job, what kind of things personally animate you. I think I work on this because I have a sort of fascination with why I can understand certain things and others not. How is it that my kids are so good at things that I'm bad at, even though I try harder? You know, that annoys me, makes me happy for them, annoyed for me. So there's a, I think, unpredictable mixture of the personal and professional accident. And maybe I would have been a, you know, mediocre director this way, but I can use my fascination with the problems of expression in the sciences.
So one of the things I often ask people is, if you hadn't been a scientist, what would you have done? I suppose that you just gave me the answer there. You'd have been an...
I wanted to be an artist. And I have to tell you, I think that doing science is actually, it's not that different. I mean, all human enterprises are human enterprises. We're animated by curiosity, greed, power, sexual attraction, accident. And whether you do this, I mean, there are, I think, strange misconceptions about how work in a lab is. You know, this is not some kind of rational engine. I mean, research gets done because these two people in a lab really love working together, and other research doesn't get done because these two people really don't like working together, and you have to separate them or something like that. They're just weird human accidents, and it's no different in business. I mean, we're ambitious. We want to succeed with grants and papers. We're vain. I mean, scientists are probably more vain than people in other domains. I mean, it animates a lot of things. It's peculiar. How is that different from the arts? You want to succeed on a personal level, on a professional level. And surely there's, you know, one hopes, some kind of underlying stream of genuine commitment to a set of ideas that you pursue. And this is what makes some scientists really great. And this is why many of us listen to Noam Chomsky's talks and read his stuff and take very seriously the path that he pursues, whether we agree or disagree, because there is a kind of commitment to the seriousness of argument and to the depth of ideas that's, you know, just fascinating and moving. It's emotionally moving. You know, many of us we read this not just because we think the ideas are so compelling, it's because it's personally fascinating. It's emotionally exciting to watch something like that, to see the ideas develop, to see how you can go from a system, in the language case, that was extremely intricate and had lots of parts, you know, a rule-based system from the 1950s with many, many different parts, to these, what's now called the minimalist theory systems, which try to make, you know, minimal assumptions about what's the necessary infrastructure. But this is an exciting path, but it's a very methodically sketched out path. These aren't sort of ad hoc decisions that abandon the original arguments. These build on the original arguments and try to arrive at an ever more simple and elegant system. And I actually, you know, there are points where I disagree quite a bit, and I have had interesting debates with Noam about this, about, let's say, would you apply the same arguments that he applied to the language system to the visual system? And he does not. Noam's not here, but we can have this discussion now. But there are interesting distinctions between the visual system and the language system, where this kind of minimalist thesis that he pursues and that we think about does not cash out in the same way in the visual system. So what's going on there? I mean, we want to have parallels. We want to think of these systems as, you know, interestingly organized. But why are there then differences? Is it because there's a longer evolutionary? So there are really points of disagreement and where we, you know, need to think through the arguments, try to figure out what kind of experimental research program would move us forward. But we just don't know. It's exciting. This is for the next 20 to 50 years. It's a great, great challenge, an intellectual, a conceptual challenge, obviously a methodological one as well.
Mm. The two scientists that you mentioned who you were kind of mentors, were at Stanford,
I was at MIT. I was an undergraduate at MIT and a graduate student, and I worked in Peter Schiller's lab in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences. At the time, one of his postdocs was Nikos Logothetis.
Oh, right.
And so I worked as an RA with Nikos and in Peter's lab. And to close the circle fully, Nikos was actually the graduate student of my father in Germany. So I had met Nikos when I was a high school student, and he was a PhD student in Munich.
And your father was?
At the medical school in Munich where Nikos got his PhD.
Okay, so
So I actually knew the social, so I actually was able to get I needed a kind of RA job because I was, you know, I needed some kind of job. And I knew that Nikos was working there, and he helped me get a kind of temp RA job. So that's how I accidentally... So, you know, the personal accidents like that are what set you down a path.
So what's the advice you give to a young scientist now?
I think intellectually, it's to be fearless in the sense of think about what's come before you and don't care about, and then don't care about it. I mean, think deeply. I mean, so for the research I do, the ideas that are for me the most informative at the moment are things like work by Hermann von Helmholtz, the physicists, and obviously work by Noam. And so, but then, you know, think about it, be excited about it, but don't be afraid to say, I just can't work with that material. Kick it away. So I think, you know, you have to be fearless and also methodologically fearless. A lot of the advances we make are because people say, you know, why can't I do that? Why can't I record from the cell? Of course I can. So, you know, methodological advances is not what I myself work on, but I'm always deeply moved by people who say, wow, you know, I'm going to figure out how to record from this thing in vivo. By God, if it's the last thing I do, I just think it's fantastic. The other thing that's, you know, as important is these in the social part of doing science is there, it has to be fun. It just has to be fun. When I walk through labs where people are sort of tense and joyless, I don't see why you want to be there. What we do is extremely hard. It's extremely frustrating. You're going to work for many years on seemingly, on you know, what seems to many people small problems of great irrelevance. And you have to have a good time doing this. You have to have a sense of humor about yourself and a sense of irony. If you have no sense of irony about your own field, then all is lost. You're going to start taking your own ideas too seriously. So fearlessness and fun are the things that are going to keep it fresh and exciting, and you know, a sense of being unafraid about your colleagues and ideas, and the, you know, kind of, there's a kind of playfulness in the whole thing.
You mentioned Helmholtz and so on. The history of this field is something that interests me as well. And one question I ask people is, if I gave you a time travel token, so you could bring anybody to your dinner table from any period of history, from any discipline, whatever, is anybody you'd love to sit down and have a conversation with?
I mean, well, certainly right now, Helmholtz would really help me. He's in the, he's at the intellectual center of many of the things I'm working about. And so I work mostly on perception problems, on auditory perception, speech perception in particular, and both actually from the physics point of view, the computational analysis point of view, as far as I can see, we're reinventing ideas that Helmholtz sketched out for us. And that, so I would actually just, from a purely idea point of view, love to have him around. And for pure raw fun, I don't know if this is true, but just from the pictures, it seems to me that Albert Einstein would be good fun at dinner. So if we could have two people to hang out with over a few drinks, it would be Helmholtz and Einstein, interestingly, physicists. I don't, I mean, there are, you know, literary figures that one would love to see, but in the sciences, I think those are people who've moved us forward in a way that is what people call, you know, kind of game-changing. I mean, throughout, you know, in their time, but still. And when you consider those ideas now, they completely change the way you think about things. So actually, in the second part of my talk yesterday, which I did not give, that where I actually was going to develop the argument of what to do next, that was, you know, the sort of aborted parts, both these figures are quite prominent. There's, I work on the nature of how time is processed in perception. And that comes very deeply from ideas influenced both by Helmholtz and Einstein. So the notion of absolute time, the way it's used by Newton in physics, is not going to work for us in neuroscience. And I actually, that's sort of one of the topics I was going to discuss, how to deal with temporal integration and perception. And the other one is the notion of efference copy, originally suggested by Hermann von Helmholtz. Says, when you plan to speak, I'm about to tell you, you know, coffee. Is it really true that you send a copy of that to the motor system, to the perceptual system? We have actually quite nice evidence that it's true in the human brain. That you have, so these are extremely abstract ideas suggested by physicists over 100 years ago, for which we now have quite lovely biological evidence, and that really place, I think, very detailed constraints on the nature of a representational system, which is our ultimate goal. So I think those are the kinds of, you know, historical figures that keep animating your work, because the set of ideas is so profound.
the place of science in society. The president, when he came into office, said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of what the rightful place of science is?
This is a very difficult spot for me. I mean, I feel very strongly about that, and right now the appropriations are being marked up for science in the U.S. Congress, and it is, you know, it goes without saying that I think science is an absolutely central human endeavor, especially in a country that prides itself on saying, you know, innovation and forwards movement is at the core. Now, last week I published an editorial in Politico with one of my colleagues from NYU, arguing against Senator Coburn, who's released a report a few weeks ago called The NSF Under the Microscope, in which he calls for the elimination of the entire division of the social, behavior, and economic sciences, which incidentally includes experimental psychology, cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience, in addition to political science, economics, sociology. That is the central recommendation of Senator Coburn's report. It will not surprise you that this kind of thing is, I think, irresponsible and incorrect, and, you know, rubs me the wrong enough way that it stimulated me to write a editorial that is, I think, many people have looked at, and I've gotten some extremely hostile comments towards from all kinds of sides, but also support from the societies. It's what could be more dangerous at this moment than eliminating that part of our research, which is not only at the center of creativity, but innovation, education, transformative ideas. The one thing we're achieving is that other countries are continuing to support their research at the same or higher levels are going to just do much better than the United States. I think other countries look at a report like the Coburn report and say, that's laughable. Do you think that France, Germany, the UK, or China, even in times of extreme fiscal crisis, have entertained the debate of eliminating core programs in the sciences? I mean, it's laughable. So there's absolutely no question that our role is central. And of course, we should have debate about the value of science, but we have peer review. The agencies in the United States that do this are very responsible. The NIH and the NSF have extensive and careful peer review. Surely there's a distribution. There's fantastic research and some that's not so good, but it's always done responsibly. And there are, yes, of course, there are always counterexamples, but people work very hard at doing good proposals. People work very hard at evaluating them. And I think government employees work very hard at trying to find a way to support research. And I think it's absolutely scandalous and unacceptable that this is not, you know, look at the kind of work we do, cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience, brain imaging, whatever, behavioral research. It's extremely cheap, very cheap. The budgets for this are extremely small. If anything, you should say, look, in this area of research, a pretty small investment can yield a tremendous amount of results. I mean, there are other areas of science where the investments have to be just enormous, you know, and where it's a little unclear if there's immediate payoff. But here, maybe there will be immediate payoff, maybe not, but you cannot curtail the creativity and desire of scientists to work on this stuff. I would think, as a politician, you would say, this is the kind of research area where, you know, $250 million can make an enormous difference. You know, remember, take the NSF, which is the premier funding agency that's not biomedical in the United States. The Division for Social Behavior and Economic Sciences, the SBE Directorate, has under it all of, this includes things like, obviously, sociology, economics, political science, also anthropology, linguistics, perception, action, cognition, cognitive neuroscience, entire division of, you know, statistics. Do you think that's relevant? I certainly do. I mean, that there are, you know, dodgy studies in every area, yes. But these are areas where the entire budget for that division is about $250 million. Is that really something you're willing to sacrifice in the sciences? I think it shouldn't be. I think it's actually, you know, profoundly dangerous. And I think it sends a signal to the rest of the world that, in fact, the commitment to the research is not there. So I think we have to fight to not only keep these kind of budgets, but to increase them. To increase them. These are the things where we're going to have very high yields. I mean, look at the fantastic research at this conference. You go through the poster sessions. kind of young, you know, graduate students and postdocs doing the most creative and fascinating stuff. And some of it is, you know, great, some of it is probably wrong, but the kind of passion that they bring to these topics, I mean, what is it not something that we should be stimulating, you know, maximally? I think that's, you know, you can see that this is something that gives me, you know, makes me quite mad, and I think is just a deeply important topic to pursue.
All right, final question. What are you optimistic about?
I'm quite optimistic about a few problems, about that actually cognitive science and cognitive neuroscience can actually solve specific things in the next year. So let me give you one concrete example. One of the things that's been studied, you know, since the beginning of available computers is automatic speech recognition. Now, obviously, that would be a huge game changer, right? So if you actually could walk up to a machine and talk to it normally, that would be a big deal. Nowadays, you have these interfaces on the phone that are frustrating and makes you want to, you know, break your phone. Or you can go to the ATM machine and it recognizes you now, but if you come back the day after tomorrow and you have a cold, it doesn't recognize you. Or you can train your own system that you can buy commercially on your laptop and you can have a dictation system. Now, that's the kind of thing that I think in the next 20 years we're going to have solved. And it's because we have really very good understanding, or, you know, growing understanding of the biological foundations of how that works, even though it's quite difficult, of kind of explicit algorithms of how the brain does. And I think a kind of neuromorphic engineering approach to this is going to be close enough that in something like 20 to 50 years, that's going to be solved. So that's the kind of example where there's an interaction between computer science, cognitive science, linguistics, neurobiology, where something that's a really interesting perceptual challenge and technological challenge can just be nailed. We can have that done. That's the kind of, and I think it's because it's an example of a research area where there is productive interaction between scientists from different areas. Where, I mean, there, you know, of course there are deep, you know, conceptual ideological divides. Nevertheless, it's a part of perception research where a lot of, if we put all of us into a room, we share a certain set of assumptions and passion for solving this, and we will. It's where, you know, really where the insights from neuroscience, linguistics, cognitive science, psychology, computer science really link together in a natural way to solve what's been a big challenge, and it's going to move us ahead in, I think, fascinating ways. That's the kind of thing where interdisciplinarity of the right type can really yield exciting progress in a good way.
All right. It's good to talk to you. Thanks very much, David.
Thanks for having me.